Testing, testing, uno, dos, tres, catorce.
He's the go-to guru for great design ideas.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
He's edgy. He's in your face.
The Frank Fontana Show. It's not just home improvement, it's life improvement.
Oh, yes, it is. And it's not just life improvement, it's mommy improvement. Yeah, there's a mom just walking by the window waving to me. And I say that because, you know, mom's got it rough out there, some moms. And, you know, a lot of things happen after pregnancy. My wife constantly tells me how she wished she could just go see a plastic surgeon and, like, get this lifted. Or not that she needs it, honey, at all. But, you know, like she would like to get a little something-something. And there's a new trend called mommy makeovers, and they're non-surgical facial rejuvenation treatments. Here to tell me about them is Dr. Steven Sherba. Doctor, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, Doc, how long you been making people look better under the knife?
I've been a plastic surgeon for 12 years now.
Do you love it?
I love it.
Yeah?
It's the best thing out there.
Did you have a choice when you said, I'm going to be in the medical field? I could do surgeries or I can make people look better?
Actually, when I went into medical school, I actually made the conscious decision that I wanted to be an artist first. And then medical school just sort of dawned on me. I was like, well, I can combine the two. This is great.
That makes total sense. I mean, going into plastic surgery, having this desire for or this hidden artist inside of you kind of makes all the sense in the world that you would choose plastic surgery.
It is. And, you know, as a kid, you just sort of go with what you feel comfortable with. And I always loved art. And suddenly medicine's interested me even more. And I made a conscious decision. I was like, you know what? I would love to be an artist, but I'm going to be a physician.
You know, back in the day, I've been in television for a long time. Before I was in front of the camera, I had a production company in South Florida. And one of the topics that I love documentaries. And I created a documentary that aired somewhere. I don't even recall. I don't think it was any like HBO, but it went into some contest and did okay. It was called The Lords of Esteem.
Nice.
I still have it somewhere. I got to share it with you. And it was all about the world of plastic surgery. How
seriously?
Oh, yeah. And it was focusing on the topic of vanity. And what price would we pay for our own vanity?
See, and I think of plastic surgery just a little bit different. Life is very short. You have to feel comfortable in your own skin. And so if you walk into a cocktail party, you think somebody is looking at your nose, and that is what is really holding you back from talking to that person you want to meet, change it. Change it so you
never
think about it again.
Think of, I mean, it's so logical. I mean, we live in a day and age where science and guys like you could do it.
Yep. You have a mole on your cheek where you just hate and you're like, everyone's looking at my mole. Well, first realize they're not. But if it really is holding you back, get rid of your mole. It's that simple.
Has the price of surgeries come down?
I think so.
Yeah.
I did a cosmetic surgery fellowship in New York City. And the guy who trained me said, Steve, you missed it. You missed the golden era of plastic surgery. I'm like, oh my God, Dr. Wood Smith, how could that be? He goes, Steve, when I graduated, a facelift and a Cadillac were the same price, $4,000.
Wow. Yeah.
Go out there now and try to charge what a Cadillac costs for a facelift.
What does an average facelift cost? I have no idea what pricing is on plastic surgery.
$10,000 to $20,000.
Wow.
So you have not kept, as a physician,
I was still thinking about the $4,000 Cadillac.
You know what, Frank? Don't do a $4,000 facelift. Right. I'm just putting it out there.
Right. I agree, because you'd probably get a $4,000 looking Cadillac
there
out of it. Oh, geez. All right. So what is this mommy makeover trend? What am I hearing all this?
Okay. So mommy makeover became popular a few years ago, and I think it's just a loosely applied term to restorative surgery of the breast and body after you're done having children or after you've lost significant weight.
Sure. And let's face it, having a baby is brutal on a woman's body, isn't it?
I agree. And I think the younger you are, the less changes you seem to have. However, different people take pregnancy differently. Some people have significant stretch marks, even if they have babies when they're young. And then moms, as we sort of like start having babies a little bit later, my wife and I got married at 35. So we started having babies later. The things that happened to her were a little bit different.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I'm fortunate, like, you know, and my wife probably hate me for talking about this, but, you know, like, her breast stayed pretty, you know, up there, and you know, everything didn't fall too far. And how much is it true about how fit you are before really plays a heavy hand on how you look after? Is there any truth
to
that?
Huge. Huge. I feel the more fit you are, the better you're going to be as a patient for surgery. In fact, the big trend in medicine as people are preparing for surgery is to optimize yourself prior to the operation.
Interesting. So what is involved in the non-surgical portion of this mommy makeover?
I think let's separate it into two. I think mommy makeovers are something that we, you know, have talked around loosely as changes in the breast and body and things that we'll do with surgery. Non-surgical facial rejuvenation, we'll talk about that separately. But I think when we talk about mommy makeovers, we're talking about basically breast and belly. If you don't like the shape of your breast, we're typically doing a breast lift, a mastopexy. If we don't like the size of your breast, well, that's an easy change too.
Sure.
Can either go smaller, do a breast reduction.
What are you using these days?
For augmentation?
For augmentation.
Yeah, and we can go and make your breast bigger with breast implants. There's two general things that we can do. One is breast implants. You can also transfer fat. But I think the more reliable way to enhance your breast or augment the size of your breast is with breast implants. Two general implants.
What materials? Silicone.
I think that saline versus silicone, that choice is very simple. When you're young, use saline. When you're a little bit closer to mammogram years, use silicone.
Why?
It's actually a more technologically advanced implant. It feels more natural, and I think the new generation of implants will be more durable, potentially being a lifelong implant.
In silicone. But you hear the horror stories. Oh, my silicone leaked. I got sick. I got cancer. Whatever it is. And again, you could probably put it into perspective of
sure.
How many of those cases are there out there.
Sure. Let's clean that up right away. First of all, there's very little to no link of breast implants to cancer. And the link to autoimmune disease also has been very, very sketchy in terms of how these things evolve in the long time. Most plastic surgeons would say that there are more people who develop these diseases without breast implants than if you studied the breast implant population. You would think that breast implants is almost protective in some weird way, but it's not. It's just the fact that they're probably not correlated. They're probably not related.
Because the news always picks up on one story. And then runs with it.
But the other thing that I think is very important to say is these new generation of implants, it's like talking about iPhones. Everyone knows that the iPhone 1 is not nearly as good as the iPhone 10 or X. Well, clearly, and so is the modern generation of breast implants. The modern generation of implants is called gummy bear implants. These implants, you cut them down the middle, they do not want to leak. And so that's very different than the implants of 30, 40 years ago where the silicone was literally silicone liquid.
What's the statistics on the amount of women getting implants these days?
Wow.
Is it still wildly popular?
I think it is wildly popular. I do between 3 and 9 augmentations a week. I did 3 yesterday. And
wow. What average age of the patient?
Well, I think it's bimodal. I think there's a young group and an age group after babies. So the young group, I feel like when they are younger, they're trying to feel more comfortable in their own skin and trying to build more perhaps ideal body ratios. So they put in implants just to feel more comfortable. Then the second group is the ones that are done with babies who are just trying to restore their body.
Sure.
I feel like both groups have a different indication, but both just trying to feel comfortable with themselves.
Eli, do you prefer real or fake?
Real.
Real. Why?
No preference. Maybe just the thought of it being natural.
Interesting. You get that a lot?
Well, I think most people want to feel natural, and nobody wants to see or feel an implant.
I don't know. I've met women before I was married who loved the idea of that perky, youthful, lifted feeling.
Let me help you with this. I think in the human race, we look at a curve of a human body, and we know that the waist-to-hip ratio has a certain ideal, 0.6. 0.6 to 0.7. The waist should be skinnier than the hips. The scary thing about that is that there is some science backing up that waist-to-hip ratio correlates with fertility. So now you are going in you're peeling one layer of the onion off.
Sure.
As to why you're attracted to one person versus the other. The breast waist-to-hip ratio is cultural. And I think that now the internet has made the world a smaller place. I think even in South America, where smaller breasts were preferable, it seems to be that larger breasts with implants seem to be at least becoming more culturally acceptable.
Interesting. We're talking to Dr. Steven Sherba from MyChicagoPlasticSurgeons.com. That's the website, correct?
Correct.
Doc, where are your offices if people wanted to pay you a visit?
I have one office downtown in the Groupon building over at 900 North Kingsbury. Then we have one right by O'Hare, and then we have one in Hoffman Estates.
And do you have a phone number you want to give out?
Our phone number is 847-853-9900.
And don't be shy, folks. I mean, everybody wants a little something done. I do.
Freak, we should get you in the office, in the doctor's office. Maybe in the next guests invite.
What do you want me to get done, Dave?
I don't know. Since you do a lot of TV and you're really taking a lot of pictures for social media, maybe a little Botox.
A little Botox?
We can make
it. I'm not against it. I mean, is there a stigmatization around Botox and those people who get Botox?
I've been doing Botox myself since I was 35. So I feel like if you are trying to prevent wrinkles, do Botox.
Let's talk about the long term of Botox, because I know people who do it. Sure. And they look phenomenal, and they look young, and their head doesn't move, and I'm okay with that.
Well, I think you got to be careful in the sense that what you're trying to do is prevent wrinkles at rest. I think you'll have some normal facial animation, but what you're really trying to do is prevent those deep crevices that we know what our grandparents look like. That's what we're trying to prevent.
Can you do that forever? Like, I have a friend who, it's funny, she jokes, but they make fun of me. Like, what do you look like when you stop doing that?
Well, I've taken breaks before, and it does kind of make you a little bit nervous because your skin starts to wrinkle again. But then all of a sudden you sort of go, well, I think it's time for Botox again. And I have taken breaks. I've done it once a year, once every six.
Do you have to take a break?
No, I just kind of did it just to see how I would look. And I would say that, you know, I'm happier when I have Botox.
I can understand. I think that's a valid statement. But again, long term, no issues, no health scares.
Not in the doses that we use for cosmetic treatments. I think that the things that people really have bigger concerns about is when Botox is being used in the thousands of units for things like muscle spasticity in children. And those are the side effects that we're more worried about, not the doses we use for cosmetic surgery or for cosmetic indications. And those are 25 units to 50 units usually.
Yeah. Okay. We're getting some callers, folks. If you want to chime in on the conversation, you got some questions for the doctor, 312-981-7200. Let's talk to Kathy first. Kathy, thanks for calling the Frank Fontana Show. Do you have a question for Dr. Sherman?
Well, not really a question, but a comment. I'm 65 and I'm in really good shape. I mean, I run marathons, I do triathlons, but I do spend some time in the sun. You know what? At this point, a few wrinkles, that's who I am. But I am so relieved that I had my baby 32 years ago when people weren't so obsessed with how you looked. I mean, this kind of pressure is crazy.
You know, and
I'm 65. I have gray hair. I've not dyed it. And I'm really to a point where, you know, I'm happy with what I am. You know what? I could dye my hair. I could get all kinds of things, but I'm still 65.
I think the bottom
line
is...
Can't fight that.
The bottom line is only fix the things that bother you. If it doesn't bother you, please don't think I'm going to try to convince you to do something that is...
But I just think this puts so much pressure on young people.
Well, I think media puts so much pressure on... I mean, I think going on Instagram and searching a feed could put so much pressure on people. I agree with you, Kathy. I think there's a tremendous pressure in our society to remain youthful and look as good as you can. Whether you buy into that, I think, is a personal decision. I think, you know, like whether I choose to get Botox or not.
Only fix the things that bother you. When I was young, I had my nose done. I was 17, 18 years old. I really didn't know that I just, you know, what was wrong with me. I just knew that
it's a personal feeling that you wanted to change.
Yeah, I knew that my nose was not the way my inner self was feeling. And so I had it done at a very young age, and now I don't even think about my nose. So I love that about plastic surgery. It takes issues and makes them into non-issues.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that he's doing this for people, but I'm just glad I... didn't have to deal with it.
In a different time. Kathy, thank you so much for your opinion. We really appreciate it. Let's take a couple more calls here. Let's talk to Rita. Hey, Rita, thanks for calling the show. How can we help you?
If a person, like a burn victim, needed a skin graft, can another person give their skin to that person or not?
Well, there are already established tissue banks, so I don't feel like you need to go ahead and donate skin to, say, a friend who is suffering from a burn. And the reality is you are transplanting a piece of tissue, so you would need to be immune suppressed to accept that graft. So there's many ways to help burn patients, and you do not personally need to donate to them. I think there's established ways to
that. It was just a question. It's not that I'm pursuing donating. I just wondered about whether it could be done.
Yes, it can be done. It's usually done with tissue banks. Yes, there's a few of them that already do it, but it's not, you know, I think it's a little bit beyond what we're talking about, but I think that you can,
Agreed.
At a certain time in your life.
I think, Rita, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. And I think it actually turns light on a real positive of what you do, Doc, is sometimes it's not just about the cosmetic and looking better. It's also about, you know, getting involved in a situation where you're going to save somebody and potentially from looking maimed for the rest of their life. life from an accident or something, correct?
Correct. Plastic surgery is really a combination of cosmetic and reconstructive surgery. And we are restoring people from cancer, from trauma, and obviously from aging.
It's awesome. Next time you're here, we're going to line this up. We're going to do a live, I'm going to just go for it. I'm going to do a live Botox session on the air. And try to stay sane and normal while you're sticking needles in my forehead.
No problem. I have very steady hands.
I don't know if it's ever been done before on air, but Eli, we got to broadcast that.
You know what? We've done flu shots. We've done...
I've never gotten a flu shot.
Well, in other shows, we've done a couple with, you know, sticking needles in
host's
faces.
Has any host got a series of probably 12 injections about, probably? What do you think? Do I need about 12?
Maybe.
Yeah, about 12 injections across my forehead. Maybe a little... Can I get rid of these crow's feet, you think?
Yes, you can soften them.
Soften them?
Doctor, now that you're here, I have a question. When you use Botox, or maybe, what is it, every 6 months, you eventually end up killing the muscle so it doesn't ever have those wrinkles. Is that true?
No, that's not true. FDA, I think it's comfortable to say that you are talking about a three-month duration of treatment with Botox. You're not talking 6 months. I think that's estimating a little high.
Well, Dave, you're talking about killing it like forever?
Yeah, because I was reading about it before the doctor came in, and I was reading an article that said it's like a muscle. If you stop lifting weights, eventually that muscle is not going to have life, basically.
That, I think, is incorrect. You are dealing with the end plate receptors that your body still has them. And you're going to be fine. The Botox will wear off in about 3 to 4 months, and the muscle will go back to acting just the same way.
Does it ever not work when you inject somebody?
I have 3 to 4 patients in my practice who Botox does not work, and we use an alternative Botox's competitor, Dysport.
And that does work?
That does work for them. In fact, this morning I did one Botox and one Dysport.
So that means that person's immune to botulism.
It's interesting because they're all blonde hair and blue eyed. Huh. Can't explain it. Every single
start one. A study. I like it. Dr. Stephen Sherba, thank you for coming out and visiting with us. We look forward to having you back on. The website is mychicagoplasticsurgeons.com. And the phone number one more time?
847-853-9900.
The Frank Fontana Show.
What factors actually matter the most for startup success?
It's not just home improvement.
Fear of the unknown, obstacles. Or maybe it was just that it was lack of motivation.
It's life improvement.
I feel like being an entrepreneur, you don't have to follow somebody else's orders.
Craving content, technology, innovation. What you craving?
Welcome back to the Frank Fontana Show, and thanks for watching, folks, and listening. If you're on Facebook Live, we appreciate you watching there. If you're listening here, we thank you so much. And right now it's time for our new segment called the Entrepreneur Showcase, where we are talking to amazing entrepreneurs throughout the Illinois area and beyond. And today, lucky to have a great guy who I met at the LaGrange business function that we did. Mm-hmm. What was it?
60 ideas in 60 minutes.
60 ideas in 60 minutes. And Jeff Pietta is here. And I keep saying it like he's Italian, but it's a Pietta, right?
It's so Polish that it sounds Italian.
Really?
But my last name is Polish.
So Polish, it sounds Italian. That's a new tagline. So tell the folks listening who you are and how you got here.
Hi, thanks. Thank you, Frank, for having me on.
My pleasure.
Having me on your show. I appreciate it. I'm Jeff Pietta. I grew up in Brookfield, southwest suburbs of Chicago, and worked really hard. I really found at an early age I enjoy solving problems. And what I've learned that's taken me is I enjoy solving big problems for work and building my companies over the years, and I enjoy solving smaller problems for fun.
How did you get into the tech world?
I remember, I think it was in the early 90s when my parents bought their first computer, and I took it apart and had it taken apart all over my bedroom. And my dad got home, and instead of being upset, he said, Jeff, I have no idea how to put that back together. So if you want to use the computer again, you have to figure it out. And then I had that uh-oh moment.
Sorry, I'm just giving my cue to Eli to go Facebook Live here, folks. Head on over to Frank Fontana on Facebook to watch this interview live. If you're listening from across the globe on WGNRadio.com/listen, you can actually watch us now. Jeff, you're born here in Chicago, and you've made a pretty big name for yourself. One of the latest wins for you was a company called ShiftGig.
That's correct.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So in the beginning of 2011 when Uber first came to Chicago, and the first time that I used the Uber app was one of those moments of like, wow, this is going to be the next big thing. But also kind of how my brain works differently is thinking, why Uber, why now? and realizing that it wasn't, you know, the first iPhone came out late 2007, Android came out in late 2008, and Uber started in 2009. And it wasn't a coincidence in that you could not make an app like Uber on a flip phone or on a BlackBerry. It wasn't until that there was two smartphones instead of 12, 15 years ago, and that they had the capability to do that. And so it was just one of those moments of realizing that the technology was there and that the possibility for Uber to exist, and obviously Uber became very successful. And then also realizing that business trends are typically easier to predict because they tend to follow consumer trends. So consumers had mobile apps before businesses had mobile apps. Uber did for consumers. Now they're doing Uber Freight. And so if you look at what's successful in the consumer sense, then it's only a matter of time before businesses start to want that, because businesses are run by consumers. Business owners and business operators are consumers themselves. And so around that same time, starting to dig into light industrial staffing and seeing how Walmart had 4,000 stores across the country with 4,000 store managers that were calling temporary staffing companies to get temporary staff for stocking their shelves. And said, okay, where Uber exists, it's 2011.
So how did you stumble on that, though, that moment, you know, where you're like, oh, Walmart or these big companies? Like, where did you find that data that sparked this idea?
That's a great question. I mean, it was a lot of brainstorming with my two partners. You know, the brainstorming process is you start with a lot of bad ideas and you kind of follow, it's like going down a rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland, and you follow an idea and you brainstorm and you know, some of them, you know, you brainstorm over drinks. And when you find an idea that you can't find anything wrong with it, then you go find someone smarter than you.
Would you mind sharing your vetting process if you have one?
Sure. And
because everyone has great ideas. I wake up with great ideas every day. But like, what's your filter? What's your vetting process?
You know, that's a great question. And you got to have the right filter for the right goal. And you got to begin with the end in mind. And I was talking with someone yesterday that wants to be an entrepreneur. And you have to first understand what you're looking to accomplish, because the vetting process for a B2B idea is different than a vetting process for a B2C idea. And so I would say that...
And for those who don't understand the entrepreneurial language of B2B, B2C, explain.
Sure. So whether the primary customer who you're trying to sell your business to is either a business or you're focusing on consumers. But I would say some of the common threads are number one, you know, focus on the problem. Don't focus on the solution. A lot of times people fall in love with the solution. So an example would be someone that wants to make an app, and because the app is a solution, and they're just trying to find a problem to solve with that, where it's like I call it a hammer in search of a nail. You give a kid a hammer, they're going to find everything that needs hammering.
Right.
So focus on the solution. What are you trying to solve? And also focus on something that's a painkiller, not a vitamin. Focus on a problem that really needs to be solved. And truly understand the problem, because it's a lot easier if you understand what the problem is and what you're trying to solve, and you fall in love with the problem, then the solution becomes apparent. And where I see entrepreneurs struggle is that they learn some new skill and they learn some new solution, and they want to try to find problems to use it for.
So in your problem that you fell in love with was staffing,
mm-hmm.
one of your problems that you fell in love with. Because you have, you know, you help a lot of people. That's not so much a glamorous love affair.
That's true. With the kind of the ironies about entrepreneurship is that oftentimes the more boring and obvious the problem is, the more valuable it is to solve it.
But there's plenty of solutions that existed around, like you said, temporary staffing. There's services that just, you know, have mm-hmm. you have access to, you know, headhunters. There's obvious competition.
Mm-hmm.
How do you weigh when you start to talk about that competition, you know, in your vetting process of like, hey, yeah, these, because every, you know, like, again, everyone has great ideas. Then they lay them out there. Then they Google it. You know, does this exist? And then you say, oh, shit. You know, there's like 200 companies doing what I just thought was my only great idea. But then those other companies who say, yeah, there's other companies doing something. I'm going to take it and still move forward and still invest and still find that niche within that. And that's what you guys did. So explain, if you could, how you navigated the potential, like, oh, crap moments where there's other companies out there kind of like it, you know?
Sure. And you know, it's it's about understanding and appreciating the reason for why the problem exists and how complex it is to build the solution, and really appreciating that ideas are easy for entrepreneurs. Execution is hard and boring. And I think the best way analogy for it is the difference between a wedding and a marriage, where someone that hasn't been married before, they love talking about the wedding, they love planning the wedding, and mm-hmm. they focus on the wedding, mm-hmm. and that's all that they're intent on. But
the wedding, reality sets in?
Well, the wedding is the one-time event. The marriage is the rest of the lifetime. And having a successful wedding, what it takes to have a successful wedding is very different than what it takes to have a successful marriage.
Yes.
And I try to help early entrepreneurs understand that your idea, your logo, the colors, the name of the company, your mission statement, that's the wedding.
The fun part.
The execution, that's the successful marriage. That's the hard part. Like, look at Tesla, for example. They weren't the first electric car. They weren't the only electric car. They didn't invent the battery. Henrik Fisker designed the Model S, and then he went and designed the Karma to compete with him. But Tesla, Elon Musk, didn't invent anything other than a better process on how to put it all together. And where I see a lot of entrepreneurs get stuck is just understanding how complex and intricate it is to execute on the business. And like having a successful marriage with someone that has an interesting personality can be more challenging.
I agree with you. I love you, honey. And I agree with you. And if you are remotely interested in becoming an entrepreneur, and it seems like everybody on social media thinks they are, and have these, you know, profiles with their, you know, their Gucci and their Prada and their fast cars and all that, but are they really living that lifestyle? Have they created something so profound or great that's made them? And some of them have. The guy sitting next to me definitely has. And but I haven't followed your social media too long, but you're not really showboating out there.
No, I prefer to just focus on solving problems.
Yeah. And you do. The core business that your company is AISlabs.com. And one of your biggest, latest is ShiftGig.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about what that does, and it services the B2B.
B2B for light industrial staffing, yes.
Okay. And we were getting into the conversation before the break about, if you have an idea, everyone's got great ideas. And then you said, like, the easy part is creating the logo, the look, the general concept. The second part of it is execution,
mm-hmm.
and the marriage, as you put it. Then it's about financing the marriage, or even before that is vetting, like you and I were just talking off air about an idea I had. Instantly an experienced guy like you are putting a whole bunch of poking holes in the situation. And that's great. Like, I love that. And that, to me, makes you think. Because, you know, I think and the idea I have is there is, like you said, there is this need in the industry for something to help fix a fault in the industry. I'm not going to give out what industry, but what it is and how we execute that is the big question mark.
Well, you do have a good idea for one of those, Frank.
Well, thank you. That means a lot coming from you. With that, as I navigate this, and I'll be calling you a lot, hopefully you'll pick up the phone, is money. You know, the next step is you vetted it. Okay, it's solid. How do you get to that place? How did you get financed for your great idea?
Sure. So I think one of the first things that you could kind of do a self-gut check is understand the concept of optimism bias. And so for even people to Google what optimism bias is. And, in short, it's, you know, if you ask someone on the street, what do they think that the divorce rate is, they'll say, 50%. And ask someone that's about to get married, what do they think that their odds of success are? Well, they're going to say, less than 50, but that they're going to more than 50% likely to succeed.
Sure.
Just like people know that 90% of entrepreneurs fail, but ask someone that's going to be an entrepreneur, do they think that they have a 90% chance of failure? That, usually they have optimism bias.
Yeah.
But as far as financing, I first encourage people to focus on the fundamentals in that many types of businesses, you don't need financing. You can bootstrap. And that if you can successfully bootstrap, then that shows a lot. I often say that...
Bootstrap. You mean kind of just...
Self-fund. Because it's I heard this 17 years ago, the statement, and I didn't fully realize it until 10 years ago, that it's easier to make $1 million than it is to spend $1 million wisely. And I didn't understand that statement because... Before I made $1 million, I think that sounded ridiculous. How is it easy to make $1 million? But in order to spend $1 million of investors' money in a manner of which results in more than $1 million of value afterwards is harder than making $1 million. So that's where you see people that are unable to even make $1 million, they are not able to take investor money and spend it in a manner that results in greater value than $1 million.
So, all right, let's talk to that youngster out there who's listening, who's got the great idea, vetted it to the best they can, but doesn't have the bootstrap capacity. Mm-hmm. Like, do you tell them to give up? Do you tell them to, like, what advice do you give that, you know, kid or that person who's at that state where they have everything ready, they have the assets ready to go, but just don't have the capital?
Sure. So the traditional sources of capital, of course, there's friends and families, there's local banks, which if you have the right kind of relationship, they could.
Need crazy credit for that? I mean, do you need equity in something?
What the great thing about local banks is that it comes down to relationships. I'm very fortunate to have had a long term relationship with First National Bank of LaGrange, and they've been great people in believing in the relationship, and that's often what it comes down to, is having that relationship. There's also angel investors, where folks that have been former entrepreneurs that like to believe and bet on up and coming entrepreneurs. I myself am an angel investor. And there's also venture capitalists. And with any of those investment sources, the most important thing for the entrepreneur to realize is what is the decision criteria of that investor, if they're going to make that investment or not. Because raising money, it is a sales process. You have to know your target market. A big part of it is, especially if it's a new idea, it usually comes down to credibility in you as the ability to execute, and also credibility in the idea.
Sure.
Because I've seen instances where it was a credible idea, it made sense, but the entrepreneur didn't have enough credibility, as the investor didn't believe that they were going to be able to execute on that idea.
Got it. And you sit here and sound like such a seasoned pro. How old are you?
34.
34. You're one of the, I think, unicorns out there that,
I wouldn't say that.
Well, what I mean by that is, like, you're young. You worked your ass off. I'm not saying you didn't work your ass off. What I mean by, in terms of your age, everyone wants to be like, oh, God, I was going to make it when I was 30-something. You know, what age did you start saying, I'm going to make it by this age? I'm going to,
It was serendipitous in that, when I was 12 years old, I was selling greeting cards and stationery. I started door to door in Brookfield, and I wasn't making very much money. And then I went over to LaGrange in Western Springs and started making more money.
Yeah. Better market.
And then I started, doing IT consulting in the 90s, where you buy a computer and you need a nerd to come by to load and install Windows with, loading 20 different floppy disks in one at a time. And now, you can go to a Mac store and you don't need that anymore.
Sure.
And then, graduated from Lyons Township High School and went to University of Illinois at Chicago for College of Engineering. And after the first semester, that was in fall of 2001, September 11th happened, the tech bubble burst, and my mom got ovarian cancer, and I decided to drop out of school and just focus on myself and focus. And what I said to my parents and myself at the time is that I have an opportunity to start a business now that may not always exist, but I can always go back to school. And neither of my parents went to college, my mom was in the hospital, and my dad was very supportive of me. And so having supportive family is very important. But
your dad supported your entrepreneurial dream at that point?
He did. I focused on success is the journey and not the result. I never focused on, when did I want to make it. I still have, very high aspirations. I remember one of my investors at Shifty told me, he said, we wanted to see entrepreneurs that shoot for the moon, and you might not make it, but if you get close, that's okay. But you got to want to shoot for the moon.
That's a really great investor right there. I mean, anybody's got your back. Did you ever fear a fear of losing money for people, like taking people's money? Did you as an entrepreneur, did you ever get scared of saying, like, oh my God, I just took $1 million from this guy. I hope I could pay it back. Or if I don't, what happens then?
Yes, absolutely. I remember when with my first company that I bootstrapped and self-funded, when we took on debt for a large expansion, and I had to personally guarantee $1 million in loans, and know that I was personally on the hook and Jeez. Having that responsibility, and also raising money for ShiftGig. I mean, with great power comes great responsibility, and it certainly is hard. And that's some of the simple messages that are out there, that you can't accomplish the extraordinary with ordinary effort. And I try to tell
damn
that to people.
Right. Damn right. Jeff, you are soundbite after soundbite. I love it. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We could definitely pick this up digitally, and we could talk more about this online. Thank you so much for
You're
coming
very
out,
welcome.
Jeff. How can people get a hold of you, or if you want them to, or we could find your company, more information on your company?
Sure. I would say definitely search me on LinkedIn at Jeff Paeta. It's P as in Peter, IETA. Also check out our new website at AISlabs.com.
You rock, man.